And we're back. Welcome to Deep Thinking, the, not just a, but the motorcycle road racing podcast. I'm Michael.
Episode number 14.
I'm Michael Gugis. He's Ed Sorbo. Here's what, listeners, here's what has happened. We have become an infinitely valuable resource. We are the official voice of motorcycle road racing, and we are simply too valuable to be in the same place at the same time. You know how, like, company executives...
When did this happen?
Oh, it happened while you were in Australia. But the,
Okay.
But this, it's like company executives can't be on the same plane, you know? So we've had to move Ed to a secure location. That way, if anything happens to me, the podcast can continue and the world can continue on the way that it is supposed to go. So,
well, I think the world will continue, but I don't know how I'm going to make podcasts without you, Michael.
Believe me, you know what they say about space travel, right? It's not that difficult. Dogs, monkeys, and senators can do it. same thing with podcasting. Why was I going to talk to you? Ed, because you have gotten an opportunity to go ride the new R1 at Eastern Creek Raceway in Australia.
Not just the R1, but the R1M on the same day.
Oh, God, I hate you.
You know, life is tough, right? It's a 10-hour flight to get there from here. And that's not horrible compared to the 13-hour flight on the way back, which tells you a little something about the importance of drafting.
Really?
Right? Well, it's huge. It's 100-something mile-an-hour headwinds all the way home. And it's tailwinds with you, and it makes a 3-hour difference.
Really?
And actually, the Air Force has done experiments where airplanes draft each other, big cargo planes. It makes a significant fuel savings difference.
For both planes?
For the following plane, for sure. I didn't see any details on the data for the front plane, but we know that from racing, the both vehicles go faster.
Yeah.
So it should have a small effect for the front plane. The problem, of course, is that in the civilian world, there's no way they're going to let you fly close enough to be in the draft. Right?
and not only that, Ed, the way that the car or the bike behind the bike in the draft makes the front bike go faster. The most effective way to do that is bump drafting, and you really can't do that in a plane.
Well, no. The reason the bike in the front goes faster is because the bike in the back is dragging the air, where the bike in the front is only splitting the air.
And
the longer you make that train, the faster it goes. So NASCAR is a great place to see an example of this. You'll have a five-car draft,
yes,
and the eight-car draft will just go right by them on the outside. Nothing the guys in the five-car draft can do.
I think technically what happens is that the trailing vehicle, the big drag is from turbulence as the air tries to close behind the moving object.
So one vehicle is braking it, and one vehicle is pulling it, and it's half the work or less work for both.
Yeah, that's the idea, that the vehicle behind helps break up that turbulent air that sucks you backwards, basically.
Well, yeah, and the longer your vehicle is, whether it's a boat or something going through the air, the more efficient it becomes.
Yes.
You part the water and you put it back together only two times, once at the front, once at the back. And so all that stuff in the middle is like three. Once you've done the work.
Right.
Speaking of which, with hull designs, do you know why the Viking ships were so efficient back in the day? Their warships?
They only had
a square sail, and they had guys rowing, right?
Right, that helps.
And the thing that made the difference was the plank design. So the planks overlapped each other,
right,
and there was a gap. They weren't flush. There was a step, and air would go under that step and run along underneath the boat.
So they were
it was a little bit of an effect of hydroplaning.
A little bit like a catamaran that comes
exactly.
up.
Exactly. Same kind of thing, right? You got less hole in the water. So anyway, we were going to talk about something having to do with riding really trick bikes on racetracks.
And Michael Gugis, in a magazine article, for a magazine article a few years ago, got to ride a Kawasaki ZX6R with traction control on the racetrack and came back with the conclusion that while there were still plenty of ways to crash a bike if you really tried, it was nice to have a little safety net there for if you got a little enthusiastic. It wasn't really a performance advantage. It's not what I'm looking for a track day bike. But I'm looking for, if I make a mistake, the consequences, I don't want them to be quite as brutal as being high-sided, you know, off the track. You know, I remember the guy. Yeah, I remember the guy. There was a guy who I sighted right in front of me coming out of turn six at Auto Club Speedway.
Traction control didn't help him, huh?
No. Oh, he was crawling.
Nothing was going to help that guy.
He was. He was crawling.
Of course, hold on. After hearing about that from you, hold on my ass. I took the opinion, like many people who haven't ridden bikes with effective traction control and other aids, and said, "Yeah, that stuff's all for sissies. I want to experience it raw. I have the skills. I can control it, yada, yada, yada." And now, having ridden a bike with effective traction control, and I may have been really lucky in this, in that I didn't ride any of these bikes while they were working the bugs out. So I didn't have to experience any of the not-so-good traction control things, like where it touched too abruptly and whacks your head on the windscreen and stuff like that.
Right.
And so I am loath to admit that while riding around on a racetrack that was new to me, after a long flight, you know, eating different foods, sleeping in a different place, being not getting as much sleep as I want, et cetera, and a clear no crash rule. By the way, I was at the Yamaha press introduction of the R1 and the R1M, working for MotorcycleDaily.com. And if you go to their site, you can read the three stories that we wrote about that experience, and I think you'll enjoy them.
Is that motorcycle?
Anyway, I'm running around on the track, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, that fucker Gugis, he was right. It's kind of like having an insurance policy. It's just making me, you know, 5% less stressed about everything that I'm doing right now, and that just made the whole thing easier.
Now,
and more fun.
Now, let me ask you, Ed, were you able to, I mean, could you actually feel the TC cutting in?
So, this bike is really tricked. besides having traction control,
right,
which is paying attention to, is the rear wheel spinning faster than the front wheel,
right,
basically, it also has slide control, which, using the internal gyro, it knows the attitude the bike's at all the time. And when it notices the bike's moving sideways, regardless, even if the wheels might be spinning at the same rate, it can cut in the same way and control that. It also has wheelie control and launch control and integrated braking, and a data system on the M model where you can download and see everything that you were doing on the GPS map and how much brake force you were using, how much traction control, et cetera, et cetera. So I only ever felt the wheelie control. I knew it wasn't wheeling because, like, I was in second gear and I just freaking whacked it too wide open and it didn't move me over backwards. I'm like, I'm pretty sure wheelie control is working here, right? But it was not abrupt. It just controlled the wheelie. Anyway, you can go on the data system and you can look and you can see that I use the slide control fairly regularly in the slowest turns. I used the traction control one whole time, and I never felt any of those.
Wow.
So, now, it had been a long time since I've ridden a 1000. I'm pretty sure the last time I rode a 1000 was in one of the Road Racing World 2000s 4 years ago or something, 6 years ago, I don't know, when I was riding regular. And I've been riding a lot less lately, and I've only been riding my 250 Ninja recently, and so I was being cautious. And I've always been smooth and steady on the throttle. I'd probably never be a big TC user, even when I'm going as hard as I can, right?
You know, that's,
and the job was get the story, get the good pictures, come back with data. The job was not make a spectacular crash and get the cover shot, you know, the British magazine way.
The British magazine way, right.
Like, those guys make an art of it. Like, they destroy your brand new XYZ motorcycle. Oh, but don't worry, Mr. Honda or whoever. We'll put the picture of the destroyed bike on the cover.
Right? You know, and that's supposed to make them feel better. That's hysterical. So I got a whole bunch of questions now. And I think this is one of the points that I made when I was riding the ZX6R, which was that I only felt it kick in when I had it on full on nanny mode and I would just pin the throttle someplace and you could feel it kind of, you know, you could definitely feel it kick in there. But if you're, you know, especially for a track day or a club racer, if you're riding smoothly, you're never going to trigger the thing. You're not going, you're
well,
not,
and, Exactly, right? They're definitely to this level now where the involvement you get with that stuff is totally, you know, down here somewhere. It's not up in your face. It's more like after you whack the throttle and when it launches you down the straightaway, getting this fantastic drive, you know what? The tracks, the wheelie control must have kicked in.
Right, because I'm not because I'm not
beating you up.
I'm not chewing on the gas cap here.
Exactly. You know, I think a good example would be the first time I ever rode a bike that had a shifter, a cutout shifter. Right.
Right.
I would still close the throttle like I normally do when I shift. I never use a clutch, but I always back off and shift. And so when it had this electronic shifter thingamajiggy, when I backed off, it would like try to shift two times or maybe one and a half, and you know, do, because I was confusing it by backing off and it was cutting the throttle.
Right.
This bike didn't care. You could keep it pinned and shift, or you could fuck around with the throttle like an idiot, and you could drive out of the pits at a quarter throttle. It was just the same every single time. So I don't know if that's some magic thing that it's doing where it's like, oh, he's only at a quarter throttle, so we're going to change the cut time. Now he's at full throttle, so it's going to be a shorter. I don't know if it's doing that or if it just doesn't need to do that. And it just doesn't have any play in the system and it works perfect all the time. But it wasn't like other ones where I rode where it messed me up. This is just perfect. And if you had the throttle closed, it wouldn't do it. It knew the throttle was closed and said, no, you don't get any automatic shifting now.
Or
quick shift, I guess you call it.
Yeah. Okay.
So I was really happy about that, right? It didn't interfere with me in any form or fashion. It just let me get on with my job. And we're going to get one of these bikes, and we're going to take it to a track day. It's going to be a track that I'm familiar with, and I'm going to ride a lot harder. And I'm going to be able to look at the data thingy, and it's going to show me how much traction control I was using and when and all of that kind of stuff. I tell you what I'm really scared about trying is the launch control thing, right? Because I've never done that before, and I couldn't do it at Eastern Creek because of the pit speed limit. And at the end of the pit, it was all U-turning, so I'm like, screw that.
No.
But I'm like, if that thing fails, I'm going to get launched to the moon.
Oh, right? Yeah. Yeah, the first time Chris Ulrich told me about, you know, trying to ride, describing launching a bike with that feature on it, I'm just like, you've got to be kidding. I don't know if I could bring my brain to do that. You know, put a ZX10 at, you know, pretty much at red line, and then when the guy waves the flag, you just dump the clutch and let the computer sort it out.
Wait a minute. What bike has a clutch engagement system? You're saying that when you engage the clutch all the way, then it cuts the power to keep it from wheeling?
Yeah, that's exactly
it.
Oh,
okay.
That's exactly the way
they described this thing to me was that it holds it at 10,000, and then you only have to think about the clutch. But, you know, now thinking about it, the wheelie control and the slide control are on all the time, so they're going to be involved in this process as well.
I mentioned this to somebody else who's an old drag racer, and he said, they were like, dude, that's old technology. You know, for drag
bikes. Yeah, but it's new to me, damn it.
Right? Yeah, but drag bikes have had this for years, you know, because there's unless you're riding like super stock or something like that. But I mean, if you're riding an honest to God motorcycle dragster, you know, you're not modulating the clutch or messing with the throttle. You know, it's the clutch engagement, that's all set for you. For last time I read up on this, the person who really determined whether or not you won or lost the drag race was the engine builder and the guy who did the clutch settings. The person who did the clutch settings. Because the rider, their job was to pin the throttle when the lights started to go down the tree and dump the clutch when they just let go of the clutch when they thought it was going to go green. You know, and the computer sorted everything else out. Ed Sorbo, did you feel at any point that the motorcycle was riding you and you were not riding the motorcycle?
No, this bike was not a 1981 GPZ 1100 in any form or fashion.
Okay.
But it was just docile and friendly and nice. It went wherever I wanted it to go all the time. The best thing about the bike, it really surprised me, was, you know, my first session was not all about, you know, making my marks and doing everything perfect, right? It was all about, oh, it turns left here? Shit, right? You know, and I'm coasting through corners and all kinds of horrible stuff like that. And it's a smooth track, but, you know, there's still rough parts, right?
Right.
But the bike never was put offline by any of this stuff. It never felt vague. It always told me exactly what was going on, and it was always, you know, no problem. Now, right, I'm an old smart guy. I didn't go into this corner that I wasn't 100% sure about, where maybe it goes left when I think it goes right. I didn't go honking in there at full speed, right? I went in there at, you know, a little above highway speed, and then the next lap I went a little faster and a little faster. So I wasn't going to put myself into any crazy situations, but, you know, I missed my lines by a few feet for the whole first session, for sure. You know, and it wasn't the same line each lap, I'm sure of that. But yeah, the bike was is an amazing package, right? The tires, the suspension, the power, the clutch, the brakes, and then on top of this magic computer system that's smoothing it all out. So in the real world, which is track day riding,
right,
and maybe some. I don't know if very many people are going to buy this bike to commute to work. You know, the thing is perfect, right?
Yeah.
You get on the straightaway, you smoke past all the kids on 215 inches, see ya, right?
Right.
You know, you get into the comfortable at a comfortable pace, and if you make a mistake with the throttle, it's not going to spit you over the handlebars. It's a fantastic bike. And I think Yamaha's paid attention to the people who can afford to buy it, right? They're not
right.
just making a bike for Josh Hayes, who's not going to have to pay for the bike.
Right.
They're building a bike for the people who are actually going to buy the things. Check this out. Almost all of the M's that are available for California sold already.
I believe it. And who's
yeah.
buying them? Is it the 16-year-olds? Hell no.
No, there's no 16-year-olds that have $22,500.
It's 45-year-olds and 50-year-olds, professionals, people who got to go to work on Monday morning.
At least guys who are old enough and have a job and a credit history that they can get a loan for the thing.
Right.
Right. They may not be 50, but they're not in high school still.
Yeah. So, and these are the guys that are going to ride it around on track days, and they can't, you know, you can't afford to get spit off the thing. You have, you know, you're supposed to close a, you know, $250,000 deal or $250 million deal on Monday afternoon. You can't show up with a concussion. You know,
that probably makes the negotiations
exactly.
a week
later, you're like, "What happened?" It's like, "You
so
idiot!"
Well, we've gotten off track a little bit, of course.
But
and by the way, you've got to watch the time on this
I've got it all. We're going to go as long as we want, and then I'm going to edit basically out everything that you say.
But we really wanted to talk about traction control and all this kind of stuff, right?
Well,
and
we did.
I've completely changed my opinion about that stuff. It's all good. Now, when we're all full-on up racing and you're using your ABS to defeat me, I'm not so down with that. But you got a traction control system on your bike so that you don't get launched into oblivion and get hurt, and we have one less racer. I'm cool with that.
You know what somebody else pointed out? I think it was Chris, too. Or it may have been Jeremy Toy I was talking to. They said, listen, you have to understand something. Traction control does not make you faster. Traction control cuts the power. It cuts the power. And I think that people perceive that there's an idea that you can just open the throttle and the computer will figure out the optimal amount of of power to get you out of the corner by judging whether it's spinning or not. But, you know, sometimes a little bit of spin is helpful. Sometimes the computer might be a little slower than the human being. The best way to do it is, and I've heard this said about Casey Stoner. I don't know. I've only talked to him once, and we didn't get into long details about his riding style. But what I've heard is that Casey had the ability to be able to open the throttle right to the point where the electronics were about to kick in. And when they kick in, they're starting to cut the power a little bit. So Casey had the ability to always be delivering maximum power to the rear wheel. I got no problem with that. I will say one other thing too, and I think this is this, and Ed, you're going to come around on ABS too when we get to that. Sorry to say. But here's the deal. I don't care what is on the bike, what's not on the bike. I don't care what the quality of the tires are, the quality of the suspension. I don't care if it's got spoke rims and drum brakes. The fastest way around the racetrack is right at or slightly above the limit of traction. And the, you know, all of the gadgets and the gizmos don't change that. You saw every MotoGP race last year, right, Ed?
I did.
Did Marquez, not in person. Yeah, right, but you saw him all on TV. Did Marquez look like he was riding with his wheels in line? You know, I watch Marquez ride like a teenage girl looks at a horror movie, right? I've got my fingers kind of in front of my eyes. I'm kind of squinting through there because it just looks, it looks for me like it brings back bad memories of waking up in the ambulance, the nice man in a uniform asking me if I knew who the president is, right? Jesus Christ. All right. We are at the 20-minute mark, which means it's time for the 2-minute board to go sideways or something along those lines. What are we calling it now?
We're calling it a 2-minute board, and I'm amazed how fast time flies when you're talking about fast motorcycles.
Oh, yeah, right? Isn't it awesome? By the way, Ed, did we get anything from Hickory Farms yet?
No, not yet, but let's not forget that when I rode at Eastern Creek on the Brabham circuit, that was my 60th different racetrack to date.
And have you kept track of how many motorcycles that you've...
I've raced 77 bikes, but I have no idea how many different bikes I've ridden.
Right, you didn't race that one. 60th
racetrack. No, it doesn't go on the race list. And I've crashed 33 times on racetracks, counting dirt.
I am just going to have to, you know, I figure if I can touch you, I'll be faster, but then you're going to call security again. Ed.
Yeah, but then you might run the risk of matching my number of crashes, and that's probably not a record you want to break.
Nah, not at all. You know, my hands still aren't, it's going to be months till my hands are back to normal, but I digress. Ed.
Yes.
You had an opportunity to ride some, actually they were street/track day tires on the regular version of the bike. What'd you think about modern street/track day tires?
People aren't going to believe me when I say this.
I never listen.
We rode the R1s first, 3 sessions in the morning, right, with the DOT street/track day tires, Bridgestone, I forget the exact name of them right now, but I'll find it while I'm making the answer to this question. And then in the afternoon, we rode the M model for 3 sessions, on slicks. Bridgestone slicks, basically the same tire, and my computer is not working right now, so I can't look up the names of the tires. The rear 190 on the DOT and the rear 200 on the slick.
Right.
The only difference I could tell between the two tires was the slightly different profile, dig a little bit harder to change direction because of the rear tire, but the feel and the grip and the feedback and all of that stuff about the tires felt the same to me.
Wow.
So I think back to a Road Racing World 1000 shootout that we did, where at my suggestion, we did the first part of the day on the DOT tires that the bike came with. My argument being, you know, a lot of these people are going to ride their bike with the tires that it comes with.
Right.
We should test the bike, right?
Right.
And then in the afternoon, we switched to some race tire where we changed the setup so that the geometry would be the same. Anyway, after the third lap or so on the DOT tires, you're like, oh yeah, this was a waste of time. The tire is a limiting factor. We can't tell anything about the bike because the tires can't handle it.
Huh.
Well, the DOT tires on the R1 were not a limiting factor. They were mind-blowingly good.
Wow. Yeah.
And if you want to go on about that, so I pull into the pits. I'm like, wow, these tires are amazing. And the Bridgestone guy's there, right?
Right.
One of their field engineers. So now I asked him, hey, did you guys bring any MotoGP tech to these tires? And he said, yes, we did, and we call it GP belt.
Now, what does this belt do again? I remember you mentioned it, but I forget now. Are you still there?
Yeah. You know what? This story hasn't been run on MotorcycleDaily.com yet.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to have to read it there.
That sounds good. Ed, thank you very much for joining us from your undisclosed location. Stay safe. You know, if in case anything happens to me, you'll get the nuclear launch codes. He's Ed Sorbo. I'm Michael Gugis, and this is Deep Thinking. Thanks for listening.
Aloha.